Hi, my name is Dawn Lai. I'm here with George Knuts, and today at his home just outside of Madison on the morning of April 20th, 2004. We'll get started here. George, where and when were you born?
I was born on May 19th, 1922, at Easton, Wisconsin, which is in Adams County, just north of Wisconsin Dells.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy Farm.
Sandy Farm.
Not too far from where Muir had his place.
Hmm.
And Leopold his place on the Wisconsin River. So three naturalists and it's a nice little circle.
Well, that's very interesting. Can you briefly describe your childhood and your early years of school?
Well, my childhood, I spent a lot of time doing a lot of work for the neighbors because it was right during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody needed money, so I was mowing lawns and simonizing cars. And we had a rooming house that we rented rooms in. And my father had boats on the river there, like the boats that are there now. We're taking people on tours mm-hmm. up through the Coldwater Canyon, Witches Gulch, and Stan Rock area. And so I spent some time guiding on the boats as I got older, calling off all the formations along the river. And we moved into the Dells, I think it was 1925. I was about 3 years old. And that's when my dad started the boat business. And like I say, I did a lot of work when I was a kid just to pick up some spare money because we needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was very fortunate to have as friends a number of the Indian boys
mm-hmm.
At the across the river
mm-hmm.
from Wisconsin Dells, at, where the Indians had their museum and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Chadwick Yellow Thunder, Miles Yellow Thunder, Archie Blue Bear, and all these young Indian boys, and they were nuts about the river. I was nuts about the river, and I spent a lot of my time when I wasn't working
mm-hmm.
with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I went much farther than they because I guess by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I was just absolutely enthralled with nature.
Yeah.
And since we had a rooming house, I would go down to the river and catch turtles and snakes and all that kind of stuff, bring them back to our rooming house and put them in various cages and had my own museum right there showing people all these things when I was just a little squirt like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would take people on hikes up along the river on the upper dells up toward High Rock and Black Hawk Lookout, and so then people were asking me questions about what kind of tree is this, what kind of tree is that. Well, this all fell into place. I started going to the library. I didn't have my own books,
mm-hmm.
and I started studying nature. I was really becoming a blooming naturalist, I guess, by the time I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there were any family members or teachers during this time who steered you on your scientific pathway?
No, because my father was strictly a businessman.
Oh, really? What did they think then about you bringing the animals home and having the museum?
they were supportive. No problem at all. My mother was that way, especially. She had tuberculosis, so
mm-hmm.
She was really close to me, and I was close to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to come out and talk to me while I was showing people the animals. And George, show them this, show them that, George. Hey, George, over there, go and get that thing out of the cage.
Mm-hmm.
Get that big old snake over there, George.
So even though your dad was a businessman, he was supportive in
oh, yeah, he could care less. He didn't support me, but he didn't go against it.
Oh, okay.
Because he knew I was working my tail off too, and there's a lot of times he went into my little white bureau to borrow some money from me until he could make it to the next. Yeah, so at that age I was helping the family with the groceries and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a fantastic interest in nature ever since I can remember.
Wow. So then that interest grew. And what year did you begin at UW, and why did you choose to study there?
Well, I started at UW in the fall of 40
mm-hmm.
and went through till December 42.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to university because it was handy handy from two standpoints. Mm-hmm. It was close to the Dells, and I had relatives here in Madison, so I stayed with my relatives in Madison while I went to UW.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main reason I chose to go there. But the other main reason, I guess, that I chose to go there is in 1940, by that time, we had moved to Black River Falls.
Mm-hmm.
My last 3 years of high school, I was at Black River Falls. And my father had sold his boat business, and he was in the Resettlement Administration. That was a federal program that bought up a lot of these farms in that sandy land where farmers couldn't make a penny, and moved them on better farms, and it converted that whole central Wisconsin area into the Black River Forest and Cedar Wildlife Refuge. He was behind all that.
Mm-hmm.
So being at Black River Falls then, and being that he was into changing this land mm-hmm. to forestry and flowages instead of farm fields,
mm-hmm.
Aldo Leopold was one of his advisors.
Uh-huh.
And Aldo Leopold came up a number of times to meet with my dad and his various biologists and foresters.
Mm-hmm.
And we had him out for supper a number of times. He talked to me, and by the time I was a junior in high school, I had an insect collection that was just endless. I was just into insects up to my ears.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so interested in those insects that he would sit, after supper we'd sit in the davenport, and I'd get out my various duplicate boxes and show him everything from butterflies to bees and ground beetles and the whole works. And mm-hmm. he just ate that stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
So then he said, gosh, he says, you ought to come to University of Wisconsin. Well, that was 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And so then in 41 and into 42, I went to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And he advised that I go into economic entomology mm-hmm. under Carl Fluke, mm-hmm. Professor Fluke, which I did. But so I got into entomology, and I was going to major in economic entomology, battle of the insects, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I was overseas one night, I was walking guard duty. And I thought, well, gosh, with my interest in animals and plants and geology, I just ate everything up.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe wildlife ecology would be better. And knowing Leopold, I wrote him a letter and I said, I kind of would like to change over to wildlife ecology when I got out of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. I changed over from entomology into wildlife ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started going into zoology in detail. Basically, I concentrated much on field zoology.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't much on this physiological stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in field zoology. I took botany as a kind of an adjunct to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say I majored in zoo,
mm-hmm.
and I minored in botany, and also I minored in geology. Mm-hmm. I took all the credits I could get in these things.
Mm-hmm.
That way, it helped me tie things together, the ground to the plants to the animals that feed on and back down,
mm-hmm.
instead of just specializing in chironomid flies or something like that from a whole life, see.
Right.
So that's what made me, I think, realize that a broad training like this makes me a better naturalist and makes me understand a lot more what goes on out there,
mm-hmm.
Rather than you know, this chironometer can fly, and just imagine he has 120 wing beats a minute and all that kind of great.
Mm-hmm. But to understand more of the holistic
yeah.
picture.
Well, it would be the environmental picture, the interrelationship, the
mm-hmm.
Everything from microclimate right on up to the whole Earth itself.
Mm-hmm. So while you were studying this eclectic mix at UW, what were your first impressions of the campus?
Good.
Good.
Loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I had been here a number of winters, too, with my relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd gone to Wisconsin High, West High, because after my mother died, I came down here and spent the winters.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met a lot of people in Madison. And just so happened a lot of those people were at the university then when I was there. So I had a lot of buddies right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. It was... I'm sure, compared to now, it was much easier to go into whatever you wanted to go into. Now they're so fussy about grade point. And I was never a real nut on grade point. I wasn't a a guy had to have this four point. In those days, he didn't need a four point.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was spend all my time on the things I was interested in and let other things kind of slide.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to look at my grade point, it would probably be not much more than a 2.5 or maybe less.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll find all A's in the ones I did go into.
Mm-hmm.
So. But it was a real nice experience. The profs were all great guys.
Mm-hmm. So after your year at UW, you enlisted in the Army, and then you came back after the war. Now, can you describe to me the UW campus as a GI student in the post-war years? Where did you live? I know there was a housing problem.
I lived with my relatives for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lived by myself out on the east side of North 3rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And the campus hadn't changed a great deal as far as the studies. But a lot of the GIs, you know, felt that they were way behind. And I knew I was way behind because I always did like mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I'll follow it up. I had to have some math at the university. I'll follow it up with trig. And I get a trig, and it was just a little bit too much for me
mm-hmm.
to concentrate on, so I learned how to slide.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I couldn't see a heck of a lot of difference, except I know that we were all far behind.
Mm-hmm. That was the overall feeling.
Almost 4 years behind, you see.
Yeah.
A heck of a difference.
So when you came back, you were mainly focused then, and I'm guessing, in on studying.
Yeah.
Were you a part of any student organizations, or
no,
did you have time for that? Okay.
I was not much of a joiner. I always had a lot of good friends and good buddies, but I never got into clubs, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Did you hold any work-study positions at your time there?
No, GI Bill handled everything for me.
Yeah, so then...
Okay. It was wonderful.
Okay. Can you please talk about any noteworthy classes or professors you had that you remember above the rest, your favorites?
Leopold, definitely. I got all his classes.
Mm-hmm.
And John Emlyn,
mm-hmm.
ornithology and mammalogy. He was my hero, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked me, and I liked him. And the rest of the profs, I guess, so-so, you know. I never had any problems. Well, I had one problem with Professor Hasler.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of these guys that for exams you had to have memorize a graph, right, to both the ups and downs and how that graph goes, instead of the principle behind the graph.
Mm-hmm.
And if you couldn't reproduce a graph by mind on a test, he'd knock it off. He'd give you a lousy grade. And I went to him one day and I said, "This is ridiculous."
Mm-hmm.
And he got mad, and I got mad.
And what class was that for then?
It was limnology, one of the limnology classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "The principles are the thing, for God's sake. Why do we have to remember graphs? That's what reference books are for."
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that. But we got along okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess, let's see, Dr. Meyer. And Dr. Wolf, Professor Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
Meyer was in embryology. Wolf was in anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
That is zoological anatomy, not human anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always impressed by their intelligence. And I really got into that at that time, the physical aspects of the body, anatomy and other than physiological
mm-hmm.
anatomy and just the physical functions of the body and human parts, and
mm-hmm.
I was always impressed by that, and comparing those parts to parts of other animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess Dr. Mossman,
mm-hmm.
he was head of human anatomy,
mm-hmm.
and I knew his son.
Mm-hmm.
So through his son, I got acquainted with the prof. And since I was an outdoor type guy, the prof said, "George," he says, "can you collect me a bunch of spermophiles?" He says, "I want to do some experimenting up here in Science Hall." So I went to the cemetery out here and drowned out and caught spermophiles for 15 cents a piece. I got, whoa. And so he got to know me real well. And then after the war, I didn't take any human anatomy courses under him. But I still knew his son, and we got together a lot. Professor Mossman and I got just like this, because the guy was an absolute expert in human anatomy, embryology, I mean, you name it, that son of a gun. I swear, he was a walking dictionary. And he was also that of a good naturalist. And so being a naturalist, him being a naturalist, we had lots of dandy conversations together. So Professor Mossman, I guess, above all else, even though he wasn't in the zoo and botany.
Still a really good reference tool.
Fantastic. And a real boost for me, too. He always encouraged me, you know. So he was a dandy guy.
Did you have a chance to do any research as an undergraduate with any?
Not much. I did a little bit of bird banding in the Arb and stuff like that. But I did a lot of research on my own from the standpoint of reptiles and amphibians and birds. I kept very detailed notes on reptiles, amphibians, and birds. And a lot of my reptile amphibian notes the DNR has now, you know, for writing out reports and stuff like this. And I gave quite a few insects to the entomology department too, to extend ranges and stuff like that. I didn't do any real formal stuff there at all. Basically out there observing, observing, and not, oh, that's a bur oak tree, you tell it by this, oh, that's a white oak, you know, what good is that thing, what is it doing, what's it feeding?
So the practical application.
How it fits into this whole scheme, see? And that's why I call myself a true environmentalist, not one of these environmentalists with the you know, they call themselves environmentalists and they don't know the environment, period.
Related to the relationship between zoology and botany departments at the time, do you remember any efforts to merge these two departments?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
And you were kind of studying under both of them, so...
Yeah, I didn't get embroiled in any of that stuff at all. I was strictly here to learn.
Okay.
In the herbarium or in those in the mammal collections, wherever it might be. Spent a lot of time in entomology even then, even though I switched out of entomology. I spent a lot of time there because I was still collecting insects. I couldn't let go of those characters.
Yeah, you still had your collections going.
Part of it, yeah.
Can you describe the general attitude surrounding scientific study at the time? Like, were you aware of breakthrough scientific work done by Watson and Crick?
I've heard the names and that's all, but I wasn't one of these guys that really got into literature. I was just interested in getting out there. What is this? How does it fit? Okay, here's an insect. My gosh, every time I collect him, he's on willow. Very tight. Well, now here's another one, and the willow looks exactly the same morphology, feeding on willow, and he's right beside this one, and they're two different species. How can that be? See, and that kind of stuff.
Just kind of putting that into place.
That was my problem. I didn't get deep enough into the genetics part of it.
The technology.
Well, genetics weren't that important then.
Yeah.
And I didn't get into that, and that was my problem. I tried to figure these things out, and I couldn't, and I go absolutely nuts trying. Why the hell does that work the way it does? Oh, gosh.
Because just at that time, genetics was growing.
Just come along.
Yeah.
You know? I had Dr. Kroll. The first lecture I ever attended, my first course in genetics, he gets up the first day, well, folks, I'm Professor Crow, Professor James Crow, Jim Crow to you guys. Well, if you said Jim Crow at his age, that's kind of nervy. But everybody kind of laughed. And I don't think we had a black guy in the outfit, but I'll never forget him.
So you didn't really follow any scientific, the technological discoveries at the time. You were mainly into the being out in the field, being in nature.
If anything, I followed the taxonomy more than anything else. And that drove me nuts because I was in it enough years. So by the time I really got into taxonomy of mammals and plants, insects.
Mm-hmm.
They changed generic names and all this. God, it just drove me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Because after study, they found their, well, that generic name is not quite right. We'll give it a new name or shift it over to this one. Now, how's a naturalist supposed to keep up with all these specialists?
Mm-hmm.
It used to drive me crazy.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, though, when you were in school, that how optimistic were people about the ability of science in general to solve the world's problems?
They were quite sure that anything that came along through the ages we would cure.
Mm-hmm.
And because everybody was inquisitive.
Mm-hmm.
That's when a lot of these things were just starting to break.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people were very optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
I know I was.
Yeah.
Just
kind of being right in the middle of it.
Yeah, getting into, you know, organic chemistry and stuff like this, just brushing the surface of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gosh, what are we going to learn as we get into this farther and farther? Well, we're into it right up to here now,
mm-hmm.
and we're still learning.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we learn, the dumber we get.
More specialized people.
I've always said that the more we learn, the less we know,
mm-hmm.
because there's always something beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can philosophize on that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I sit in the backyard with my cigar and do some thinking.
Mm-hmm. So then, after your years at the university, you started working for the DNR.
Yep.
And what was your position there, and what were your responsibilities at first?
I started out as a wildlife biologist.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on beaver for 8 years, 50 mm-hmm. to 58. I worked on a statewide research project on the beaver.
Mm-hmm.
Distribution, food habits, reproductive potential, you name it. 17 mm-hmm. jobs. And then the last 2 years of that 58, from 56 to 58,
mm-hmm.
I also worked on otter, because otter and beaver, you know, are practically side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And I got interested in them, and about that same time we had these PETA type people. Oh, don't ever trap a cute little beautiful otter. And they were just giving us a hell of a time because we were trapping otter.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we were trapping otter is they could take it. I found from their reproductive potentials that they could take the amount of trapping that we were giving them, because we were trapping them every year, and they were holding and actually increasing and going down. And they're holding.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this PETA type person, you know, in those days we had them too. Well, Mr. Knutson, they come to our meetings. We cannot trap otter anymore because we know for a fact there are only 19 otter left in the state. That's the statements they would make, see. And I'd say then, well, it's a funny thing, because when I was up in Otokotik Flowage here, I saw one family of six, and I saw another family of three, and that makes about nine of them right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just they drove me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, the reason we're trapping otter is because it's a prime pelt. We are not hurting a population if we do not trap otter, since we do trap beaver, and everybody wants beaver trap because they raise a lot of hob in a lot of mm-hmm. places. We trap accidentally. We trap 300-400 otter a year accidentally
mm-hmm.
in a drowning set. What do you do with it? Throw it in a brush. Let the guy salvage it, maybe get your harvest up to 800-900, and everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically it. It was a trade-off there.
Mm-hmm.
And finally they just shut up anymore, and that was it. But I got a temper. When they argue against me and come up with a figure like, there's only 19 hour left in the state, drop kick them right over the end goal.
Because you knew better. You were out there.
Jeez.
To
this day, I go around with some of the people.
But
then in 1958, I swung over and did a four-year project on the black bear.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mostly summer work. Yeah, so I write up my stuff in the winter, you know, and then I still write a lot of my beaver stuff up, because through those years I was finishing off a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on black bears and live trap and ear tag, about 180 of them,
mm-hmm.
not counting retraps,
mm-hmm.
and learned a lot about the black bear.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1962, I was offered the job of chief naturalist because Roman Koenigs, who was in the forestry department at DNR, had seen naturalist programs in some of the national forests and national parks, and he thought we should have that here. So he said, George, he says, you're the naturalist in the outfit. He says, how would you like the job? Just like that, I got it. Now I'd have had to, you know, compete. I still would have got it if I'd have competed, because, well, I'd have got it, to my knowledge.
So there wasn't really like an interviewing process or anything at that time?
So I took it over and away I went. I worked on that for 23 years and developed our naturalist program or interpretive program. And that was a real intensive program. I spent hours and hours and hours on that in the field and right at that desk making my drawings for my nature labels. I just ate it up. I ate every minute of it. And again, those nature programs I put on, and the naturalists I hired to put them on, delved into ecology, not, oh, let's look at this baroque. No, isn't that a pretty violet? You know, that's nice, but what the devil did they learn? So we always carried further into the principles of various things.
Did your position, with your position, did your responsibilities change at all over time? Because I know since you were in the position for so long, or did they kind of stay steady?
Oh, no, I changed a number of things. Well, I didn't change them, anything, just I added things. See, I developed, well, you can put these figures down, roughly 65 labeled nature trails in our parks and forests. I was under the parks division because parks and forests broke up. There used to be one outfit, and parks went by itself, forest by itself. But I still was a forest naturalist, too. So 65, plus or minus, labeled nature trails for that, and probably 10 or 15 that I worked for various counties in our county parks, volunteered to set up nature trails for them with labels or brochures. A lot of times brochures, because they didn't have money to make the labels. Put a number posted, you know. And then I developed nature centers. I developed, I would say six big ones. Devil's Lake Peninsula Park, Wyalusing Interstate. Those were big nature centers. And, you know, exhibiting features of the park and explaining them. Nature museums, basically. And then I hired up to 20, 25 seasonal naturalists, students like yourself, to work in the parks, take people on guided walks, and also give evening programs, because I developed a number of evening programs. I developed programs for our major parks, where we had an amphitheater, or a place to show slides, on the geology of the park, the wildflowers of the park, birds of the park, whatever, geology of the park primarily in a lot of cases, because our parks are geologic wonders. So I spent a lot of time on developing nature slide programs for our naturalists to use. And then, so it'll be the label nature trails, I hired the naturalists, the nature exhibits, the museum. Then I was really instrumental in the scientific areas Preservation Council. That's now the Natural Areas Division. Recommending areas that were rare, had rare plants, rare communities. So I worked with them for a long time, Scientific Areas Preservation Council. And then I also recommended a lot of different species for endangered species lists. And followed up on checking them out whenever I happened to be nearby, see how they're doing. So I was into a lot of sideline stuff, but still, basically, it took a naturalist type to really appreciate this stuff and have the time to go and look for it, see. So I spent a lot of time with that, too. And I gave a lot of evening programs to Kiwanians and Rotarians and everybody but the environmentalists. By God, they didn't invite me much. I was so mad at those people, always yakking about this and that. And to this day, I can't get those people to invite me at all. I got a lot of ideas I'd like to get to them, but I just have given up on them.
So would you say that they were some of the people that had differences in opinion on how to preserve the land
preserve,
and the
preserve,
animals?
Preserve everything, mm-hmm. see. They forget that nature's dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, our dynamics that we impose on nature change a lot of things badly, I mean, for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of things we do that help the environment too.
Mm-hmm.
And that is from setting aside natural areas, scientific areas, endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping your eye on them, in other mm-hmm. words. But they were just preserve. Don't ever cut a tree. Don't ever do this, don't ever do that, see.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that, but there's
problems
no
in that
real
direction,
reason for it.
Yeah.
See what happened in the Rocky Mountains now?
Mm-hmm.
Preserve. Boy, don't let those babies burn. Now they're all going because they got kindling out there like if I put a whole bunch of matches here and let her go.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Can you talk about some of the other people whom with you worked most closely during this time as chief naturalist?
Well, I worked with national parks people.
Mm-hmm.
We had the what we call the Association of Interpretive Naturalists. We about six of us from various states and national parks
mm-hmm.
set this up back in about 1963 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with them a lot. I was on the board, and what we did there was had annual meetings going over new principles of interpretation,
mm-hmm.
city interpretation within the city, interpretations in the country, interpretation in national parks,
mm-hmm.
state parks. So I did a lot of work with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also published a little booklet called Nature Hike Themes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, sort of a cookbook as to the title, and then here's how I explain something on this title. In other words, birds by sight, sound of sign, or what's in a square yard,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of stuff. And how do you get people to sit down and look at these things, see?
Mm-hmm.
So that went over, boy, that went over real well. I published the thing, and then I started distributing it to various naturalists, and they distributed to other naturalists. Before I knew it, national parks and everybody else would, hey, send us about 100 of them, will you?
Mm-hmm.
So that really went over good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one I would like to just, before I die, I would like to sit down and write up as a book
mm-hmm.
instead of just a booklet.
Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't take me long to do either because I got so many ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I could flap my gums all day and give my voice would last.
And you're still very passionate about the work that you did.
What's that?
And you're still so passionate about the work you've done a number of years ago. During your time as chief naturalist, can you describe your relationship between the DNR and the university? If any, did you work, collaborate on things, and did this change over time?
Well, I guess the closest I came to work at the university was just a meeting with Dr. Shorter,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes with Dr. Leopold.
Mm-hmm.
or Emlyn,
mm-hmm.
and they would have me come and give a seminar sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Or Johnny Emlyn used to say, George, he said, I got a whole class of real eager beavers here. Let's go out and look at some beaver.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd make my field exam first and find out where I could sneak about 20 kids in, spend about a half a day building a nice natural-looking blind out of twigs and branches.
Mm-hmm.
Next morning, before dark, whole class would sneak in there and we'd be there, and almost invariably we had good luck beaver coming out and cutting down a tree for us and all that stuff. Oh, Johnny Emlyn, being a professor and all this, he had all the right to be a stuck-up guy, but he wasn't. And he used to just praise me all the time about how I could do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
But I And, you know, I gave specimens on occasion to the university. I never had a real rare thing I would give it, either to the mammalogy collection of bird people or bug people.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as any liaison with them, only with wildlife ecology.
Mm-hmm.
I talked a lot about wildlife ecology students,
mm-hmm.
to give them advice. Tell them how I set my programs up and how you should set up a program if you're going to study anything from mice to the rats, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of good there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. A lot of communications with wildlife people.
Mm-hmm. During your time as chief naturalist, did you face any political pressure? And if so, over what issues?
Only political pressures? Well, they weren't even political. Like I say, they were pseudo-political because of the protectionists versus the users, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically where I think the problem was between us and them, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go and give talks to them when they'd invite me, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get so damn mad. I could see their side. I can remember a number of times. I know how you people feel. When I go out in the field,
mm-hmm.
and I see an animal suffering, it bothers the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
When I see an animal trap, it bothers the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only one death, and that animal is only going to die once.
Mm-hmm.
And usually if a trap is set properly, it's not going to last very long in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I'm traveling from here to there, and I see an animal on the road that's still kicking, suffering, I'll get up and put it out of its misery. How many of you people do that? Oh, we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a far out example, but that's the way I felt that they felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I went along with it because I said, I'm a naturalist. I love animals more than you. And mm-hmm. I don't like suffering any more than you. But did you ever see a red-tailed hawk grab a rabbit and sit out there, rabbit screaming his head off while the hawk is tearing chunks out of him for 5 minutes before he finally gives up and he's dead?
Mm-hmm.
They don't like that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nature.
Yeah, right, that's nature, and that's how it works.
Boy, one that I used to love, how many people brush teeth in the morning, you know, little asthma. Just think, all those antibiotics and all that stuff in your toothbrush, killing all those little bacteria in your mouth. My God, there's a lot of deaths in just your mouth. Lousy example, but
mm-hmm.
I think they kind of think about, we better not go any farther with this.
Mm-hmm. So that was one source of tension during this time. Did you feel the effects of growing distance between experimentalists and naturalists during the 60s? Kind of the basis of doing things?
I didn't feel it, no.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I say, I wasn't into the experimentalists at all. I'm
mm-hmm.
strictly the fact finder.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent my time out there learning about beaver reproductive potentials and dissecting. I dissected over 1,800 beaver
mm-hmm.
to get at the female tracks and see how many corpulidity they had from litters last year, how many they're carrying this year,
mm-hmm.
and all the real factual part of an animal's life,
mm-hmm.
the animals I specialize in especially. And otter, well, see, the other side of the otter story was a trout fisherman ate their guts. Oh, they're eating all our trout. Flarf, they are not eating all your trout.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go around on them. Finally, I said, well, we're just going to look into this. So I wrote all the trappers, and I said, if you guys skin your otter this year, save that carcass,
mm-hmm.
and let me know, if you will, and by a certain date, so I can come and meet you at a certain place and pick them up. Well, it worked out slick.
Mm-hmm.
I dissected all over, I think, 668 otter tracts, and I examined the intestinal tract,
mm-hmm.
the large intestine, and the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be surprised what I found in there. Very few trout, and this is from trout country. Lots of chubs, lots of suckers, lots of big banacid and the dytiscid beetles and stuff that kill baby trout.
Mm-hmm.
See, so I've indicated them there. But
That they weren't eating all their children.
No, they weren't eating all these things. Yeah. Facts like that, you, I just love that kind of stuff because I had something to rub in her face a little bit, see.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very intensive work. And when I first started working on my beaver, it was at the Nevin Hatcher here. That's where I kept all my stuff preserved.
Mm-hmm.
But I would bring them home at night when we lived on the east side, and I'd, you know, in the basement until 1 or 2 in the morning, dissecting out all this stuff, putting the old mic on, you know. And there's a scale of a umbrellini or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, there's a tarsi with a big old digestion. Wow. Mm-hmm. Just eat that stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
Just love it.
Another thing during the time, did you recall Rachel Carson's publication of Silent Spring?
Yep.
When did you first hear about this book?
Well, right after it was written.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the date, but we were back there.
Right away.
I read it. Yeah.
You remember reading it?
Oh, yeah.
How, if at all, did it impact you, the work that you were doing at the
time?
Well,
I went with her, frankly, all the way, as far as I was concerned. She hit the nail on the head. Certain things I would argue with her, I think.
Did it lead to any important changes in Wisconsin? As far as, did you have a role in the Wisconsin decision to ban DDT?
To ban what?
The banning of DDT in the late 60s.
Did I have any part?
Yeah.
Only insofar as I heard that it was destructive, and
mm-hmm.
I gave all support in the world, especially from a standpoint of data that I, well, it wasn't solid data, it was observational data.
Mm-hmm.
On the big drop off on cougars,
mm-hmm.
sharp shins, bald eagles, and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, many times I brought that out of meetings. Damn right they're down. I'm not seeing them like I used to. I didn't take a lot of detailed notes on every time I saw one.
Mm-hmm.
Just overall observations through the years. Boy, they're just like nowadays. Where the hell are the warblers anymore? They're gone
mm-hmm.
compared to what they were, see.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, boy, the bald eagle was conspicuous by his absence.
Mm-hmm.
And they were tying it up with DDT all the way with that. And my Cooper's Hawk, that was one of my favorite of all birds, because I used to have those when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to train them to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Never were very good, but I loved that bird.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, when they start disappearing, I damn near bawled.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a bird, that's the bird of birds as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Maneuverability, well, they used to call them blue darters, the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Into a chicken yard, boom, there's a chick gone, the bird's gone for a farmer knew what was happening. That's a bird.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
You would say definitely that publication made an impact.
Oh boy, it sure did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So definitely a lot of things going on there during your time as a naturalist. Can we go back to one thing? Earlier you mentioned that you did do personal research just in the Madison area. And I know that you described your days in the Arboretum as being deeply philosophical. Can you explain this a little bit more?
Yeah, because I was in the Arb. See, I came down here the first winter my mother died. That was 1932. That was the winter of 1932-1933. And I was just 10 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to walk through the Arb then. Before it was the Arb, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the time Leopold was eyeballing us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I do remember, believe it or not, I remember some of the things I saw then that are not there now.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the changes, I think, and I saw definitely the changes in that lake.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to scuba dive out there with my own scuba gear. I rigged up my own bass.
In Wingra?
Yeah. Boy, swim along there, bluegills all over the place, big old bass looking at me from weeds. Now you can't see 2 feet there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and then the Arb itself, I kicked around some of the Indian mounds. I didn't destroy them. I was kind of looking around for artifacts. At that time, I thought they were all the way through the thing, but instead of down in the mound. I never did find an arrowhead, but I remember being absolutely amazed at the Indian mounds in there. And I did a lot of insect collecting then in the Arb after 1940, when I finally came down here and went to school.
Mm-hmm.
And before that,
when I was just a little guy, I did some collecting in there. I guess 1935 or 36,
mm-hmm.
I collected ones of insects in there. 1940, I guess I realized about that time how things were changing.
Mm-hmm.
The springs were changing, that, you know, the springs down there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that used to be just loaded with pickerel frogs.
Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, they'd hibernate under the rocks, or not hibernate, but estivate,
mm-hmm.
under the rocks in the watercress.
Mm-hmm.
You turn over a rock and pull up some watercress, and every two, three legs kicking, you know, the leopard frogs in there were smacking it in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that, they disappeared. Why are they disappearing? What's happening here?
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, when I was younger, I used to spend a lot of time along the shore. I'd walk all around that lake,
mm-hmm.
and there was always a number of what we used to call banded water snakes,
mm-hmm.
the brown water snake now. They're a thing of the past. There used to be fox snakes in there. They're a thing of the past. And what used to be a nice alder bog, now where it gets dry enough, is nothing but a honeysuckle bog, European honeysuckle. I've seen changes like that. I've seen this doggone mustard come in, you know, what the heck is that?
Mm-hmm.
So here it is, and I mean, we got it. So I've seen a lot of changes there, but the thing is, I philosophized way back in those days. I remember sitting by that well, or that the spring, since I knew Indian kids from the Dells.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, anyway, I used to sit by the springs there, wonder how many hundreds of years Indians would come to that spring for their water. It was a beautiful spring.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a beautiful spring, still is.
Mm-hmm.
And think about, gee, here I am. I'm certainly not the first guy who was here. I wonder what they were doing and how they looked a couple hundred years ago when they were here with their little pottery jug picked
mm-hmm.
up water. And the spring itself, at that time, that lake was so clear that the spring and the creek going into the lake had trout in it. I think they were transplanted there by DNR maybe back in those days even.
Mm-hmm.
But I know well before that, as clear as that little lake was, as nice as that spring was, I think there were native trout in there too.
Mm-hmm.
That's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to sit there, and no matter where I went in that crazy place, I was philosophizing about this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially a lot about the Indians that lived there, and then especially the formation of that lake and our four lakes here, knowing the geology and glaciology behind that.
Mm-hmm.
That just amazed me that the glacier gave us all the gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think about before, it was a drainage basin before the lakes were here.
Mm-hmm.
Then when the ice came down, it was thicker in those valleys,
mm-hmm.
so it dug deeper. And when it backed up and left the ice blocks, and that's when the lakes were formed, ice block lakes. But I tried to picture this whole thing. It was creeks, you know, a million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then the glaciers start moving down. And then after they backed out, there's still the old basic creek valley here, but it's widened and it's deepened. And now it's got lakes in it where it used to be just a trickling little creek.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know enough about that kind of stuff, you can see a moving picture of it in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
When I go west, I study a lot of western geology, through geology, the Rockies, especially Utah and Idaho and Montana, and I drive through some of those cuts of Philite rock and all that, and I'm just thinking, Jesus, I can see that stuff forming. It was clay, and the upheavals came, pressed together, and then it slid, made all these plates, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just feel it.
Mm-hmm.
The more you understand this stuff, the more you appreciate the earth.
Mm-hmm.
The more you realize what the devil went on to form this thing.
Just how dynamic it is.
Are destroying, or maybe those of us that are not destroying it are not looking at it the way we should.
Mm-hmm.
We're not appreciating it.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate everything about this earth. And when I look at a mountain and understand a little bit about its geology, or Lake Wingra,
mm-hmm.
or Mandura, or this slope you were sitting on right here.
Mm-hmm.
This was glaciated real nicely. Not too far up the hill here, if I dug down, I'll come in absolute contact with a big old sandstone bluff. Used to be there before it got all filled up.
Mm-hmm.
I often wonder how far down that went. Probably 80 feet
mm-hmm.
before the old creek bottom was,
mm-hmm.
could be found. And, you know, that, I did, oh man.
Interesting to know what you're like. Sitting on.
Yeah. And then I get much farther into things as I philosophize, like the unanswerables.
Mm-hmm.
We know so much, like I say, and yet we know so little. And are we ever going to explain everything? Like, here's a good one. You take a look at the eye spot on a Cecropia moth.
Mm-hmm.
It's tan in the middle, kind of a light blue line, gets darker, tan outside that, and a russet color on that.
Mm-hmm.
And another one, a mile from here, looks the same. Ohio looks the same. California looks the same. No, well, that's genetic, sure, that's the DNA. You bet it is, but how the devil is the DNA put those little pigments in perfect
mm-hmm.
formations all the way around? You'll never explain that.
Mm-hmm.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's when I get uptight.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could explain it.
mm-hmm.
But I don't wish I could, because it's nice to have that as a buffer.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about moths. Can you go into maybe what was your most interesting find at the UW Arboretum?
You better believe it. And this one was Floria. 1941. That summer before we went in the Army. I went in the Army in, let's see, 42. I went in the Army. I went in the Army, just before Christmas in 42, so it was the summer of 42. I'm in the Arb, sugaring for moths. You ever done that?
I haven't.
Boy,
yet.
That's fun. Maybe sometime we can do that.
That'd be nice.
You got a farm down there?
I have a farm close to Dodgeville.
Well, we could do it. I'd like to be able to do it in the Arb, but I don't think they'd let me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's back when, you know, there weren't any restrictions there. I think I probably decimated the whole insect population in that arboretum at one time or another. But anyway, I was sugaring for moths. Had a lot of nice catocala coming in. Some of these great big phytolax and stuff like that. And boy, this is great. And there's a great big old elm tree. You know where the headquarters are.
Mm-hmm.
You know where that one shelter is?
Mm-hmm.
That rock shelter mm-hmm. that closest to it?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the fox snakes used to be, too, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
In those cracks and crannies. Hey, George, you here again? Peeking all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I used that as my headquarters for sugaring for moths. And I went through the woods, tried to find the easiest path so I wouldn't make a lot of noise, because these things don't like let the moths will fly if you approach and make too much noise.
Mm-hmm.
So I had sugared a lot of trees, and I had sugared this great big slippery elm there, big old red elm. And I had a miner's headlamp on, because I had my carrying case here, my killer jars, and a net here, see?
Mm-hmm.
I focused on a tree about 50 feet away. Whoa, there's a big moth. August? What the? You know, well, June is the month the big moths are out, the Cecropes, Polyphemus, Promethea, Cynthia, mm-hmm. and all these. That's way late, way too late. And doesn't look quite right. Got angly wings. Boy, is that a big. This is all going through my mind. So I stalked them. You want to see a tiger stalking a sandbar deer, boy. I was stalking that sucker. And geez, I got within maybe 8 feet. And I wasn't hitting them directly with the light on to keep them, you know, just so I could see them.
Mm-hmm.
And son of a gun took off. Oh, jeez, now I'll never know what the heck it was. Well, as luck would have it, I always added, not always, but usually added a little Jamaica rum to the closer,
mm-hmm.
and they would get drunk. Mm-hmm. They were much more tolerant, or sometimes they couldn't even fly.
Mm-hmm.
And sure as hell, bars flopping, and over through some dogwood, he's on the ground flopping around. Well, then the stalk was over. I dove on him, got in my jar, and I just abandoned everything that night because I didn't know what the devil it was.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get back. This is about 1 a.m, and I walked all the way from Van Nuys Street,
mm-hmm.
near the stadium,
mm-hmm.
to the Arb. I walked all the way home. Well, every time I went down there, I'd walk. And so I got the books out. And, wow, Thysania Zenobia. Ooh, Thysania Zenobia. So I read up on it. Yes, this is a South American and Central American moth found only so far in the Texas up to that time.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one in Wisconsin. Oh, talk about a find. So I mounted the thing and all this and that. And it was too valuable for me to hang on to. So I sent it. I can't remember if it was American Museum of Natural History or the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you can have this for your collection because it's so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only record for Wisconsin, and about 1,000 miles from here is the only other one that was caught.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then I said, if you would please let me know how you think that moth got to Wisconsin, I would appreciate it. Well, I can almost give you a verbatim the letter. Well, thank you for the specimen, but how the heck should we know how we got there?
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea. But I got thinking, I'll bet you that some of the gun got here in a boxcar or something,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was good. First specimen, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You bet. Then one day I was talking to Bill Seeker. He was an attorney in Madison here, and he was a moth collector.
Mm-hmm.
And talking moths, and I said, you know, Bill, I said, I got one first record for Wisconsin in a moth called Thysania Zenobia. Where'd you get that? I said, the Arboretum. So I caught one there too, 1947 or 48.
Mm-hmm.
What? Well, geez, I still had him scooped.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I still got to beat Bill, but how did he get here?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't a boxcar. They must migrate this way.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody collected them in those days, you know, mm-hmm. extensively, so there were a lot of them between here and Mexico, too, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I still got the first record, Bill. Yeah, you do. Well, one day I'm thumbing through, I got this great big four-volume set of Geology of Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
by Chamberlain and the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, Hoy and Higley were doing the fishing, and Mendota, and various people were doing some of the insects. And I started reading down through the insect column. Thysania Zenobia, Racine County, 1871. Well, how's that for a story? Dirty rats scoped me by 70 years. So that's
the way it still goes. A great find.
Oh, I tell you what, I'll never forget that as long as I live. It's a beautiful moth, too. It looks like a snorkel mark.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. I'll show you a picture.
Okay.
But that plus a lot of other insect finds and bird observations. I've made a lot of, well, Professor Hickey, you probably heard Professor Hickey.
Mm-hmm.
He and I used to go around and around. He was an ornithologist, you know, him and his wife both. And we used to go around and around. George, you didn't see that. Now, George, that had to be a, you know. Now, Prof, no, it was a, mm-hmm. Well, one day he nailed me. I belong to the Kumlian Club, which is a bird club. It was, not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Just the Ornithological Society now. But I reported seeing a yellow-breasted chat in the parking lot,
mm-hmm.
in the Arb. And Hickey says, George, nah, he says, that was a yellow-throated vireo. And I said, no, it was a chat. But they look a lot like George. He says, that was a vireo. Damn it, that was a chat. I know chats. I was in the Army. I had chats all around me in Alabama. Sure, it's a southern bird, but they do come to Wisconsin. So that's the way it used to go, see.
Mm-hmm.
But I did see a chat there. Well, since that time, chats have been seen there too. So it's just how many people are observing them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what makes it so. I could write a book on some of these crazy things that happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I really killed him because we were sitting in the East Marsh before it was all grown over by honeysuckle.
Mm-hmm.
You had a class out there. You know? We're all sitting in a grassy area, and Prof. Hickey is talking. And he says, and this is late September, early, you know, early October. He says, well, look there. He says, there's a late date for a cuckoo. And none of us said anything about it. It was a late date for a cuckoo because it was a morning dove. So, and we all agreed to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's obvious, though, that your passion for nature is still well alive.
Oh, geez.
And after all these years, you certainly must feel accomplished.
Oh, yes. I feel like I could live it all over again, and I would enjoy every minute of it.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the work at the department. You know, you always have bosses you don't like,
because
they don't have, in my case, they didn't have my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a hell of an imagination, so I used to go around and around with them on that. But there wasn't a job I had at the department I didn't love.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where I go nowadays, I eat up nature. I'm working in the backyard here to see some old buddies. And here's the thing that I think it shows how interested I am in these things. I can tell you the scientific name of the only individual of a certain insect that I've ever collected,
mm-hmm.
like a less common one,
mm-hmm.
a southern one from here, a northern one down here.
Mm-hmm.
I can still tell you the scientific name of where I saw the fool thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now if I were to repair radios and somebody tell me to memorize radio parts, I'd quit it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just how intense I am with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I can rattle off actually thousands of scientific names, and not just here, but West and Europe. I did a lot of birding over there in my spare time.
Mm-hmm.
I still got the scientific name. Maybe use it once or twice over in my notes,
mm-hmm.
and I still remember, you know, Corvus Corks, and
mm-hmm.
Corvus Monodula, and all these guys.
So now you've got more spare time, now that you've retired, to do these types of things out in the backyard. When and why did you decide to retire?
Well, it was at a point when my retirement would be at the maximum, with basically the minimum amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
I could have worked 4 or 5 more years,
mm-hmm.
but I had other things I wanted to do. I was trying to get a book written. I wanted to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of other things I wanted to do. I wanted to have more freedom now to get out and check endangered species and stuff like that that I had located initially, see how they're doing now, 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to check a lot of our rattlesnake dens because they're going downhill too.
Mm-hmm.
And all these kinds of things. I wouldn't have time to work for the state because I have to work with the interpreter program. So I retired and somebody else took over my job,
mm-hmm.
which kept the thing going, kinda. And then I got back on track with my field work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, late years here, I'm slowing down. And
mm-hmm.
I had not a lot of health problems. Up till 70, I was healthy as I could be, but at 70, I found that I had prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They cut that out and then they radiated me, and the radiation screwed me up more than anything else. And then I had a heart valve repaired. So I'm not as active as I used to be as far as getting out to all these areas I wish I could get to.
Mm-hmm.
I want to climb some of these hills and get those rattlesnake dancing. And not just for the rattlers, but black rat snakes and milk snakes. See if they're like they used to be. See,
mm-hmm.
just can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The hills are steeper, the air is thinner.
Mm-hmm. During this time, though, have you kept in contact with any fellow alumni or DNR colleagues at all?
Not much.
Not much.
That's the funny part. All my game guys in wildlife ecology, a lot of them are dead now, and they were professionals in their field, but no real interest in it other than their work.
Mm-hmm.
They majored in zoo or whatever it might be, and got into wildlife. Once they retired, that's it.
And when I worked at parks, you'd think these people would have an interest in the outdoors. All the guys I worked closely with there, they didn't hunt, they didn't fish, they do nothing. So I don't have a lot of contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't understand that. Some of the neighbors around here are not naturalists, but they're a heck of a lot more interested in some of these things. Like compadres.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you said when the next person took over, you said it kind of kept things going.
Oh, yeah.
Did this person ask you along their way of learning for any advice on how you've done it since you were doing it for so many years?
That's what burned me more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We had a gal take over, Sue Black.
Mm-hmm.
She was with the county parks before that. She finally took over. Some years after I'd quit, but she didn't do diddly with my program.
Mm-hmm.
The gal that took over as chief naturalist, a nice girl, I hired her as a seasonal naturalist up in Wyoming County for
mm-hmm.
a couple summers. But she mm-hmm. took over then, and I told the new parks director that if you want me to come and talk to you about my program, and give you some ideas, God, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
Not once after I left did any of them ever call me back.
Mm-hmm.
So I got suspicious and I checked out a few of these things. My label nature trails are a thing of the past. Cost too much money. Doesn't cost that much for mm-hmm. a good thing to get out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And my union programs, they're carrying on some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the gal that took over started a different program called Natchez Rangers or something like that. After the kids went a certain number of hikes
mm-hmm.
in the park, where they get a little badge or something. It's nice.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't get anywhere near into the ecology
mm-hmm.
and the nature of ecology that I did. And in other words, the program just went
mm-hmm.
I don't even go and check now because I'll ball if I do.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they don't have money now either, so that would be part of it.
Makes things.
I can't blame them for that, but
right.
I try to keep my program as cheap as I could. And I made a lot of calculations at the end of some of the seasons on based on registrations
mm-hmm.
at the beginning of the nature trails and number of people attending evening programs. And in that 2.5-3 month period in the summer, my program handled at least 550,000 to 800,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And if only 2% of them developed a little more interest, that's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And my nature walks, I know my naturalists had the same experience as I did. After my nature walks, people would come up to me, Mr. Knudsen, we never realized how wonderful nature is, how closely knit these things are, or how beautiful a flower is, if you look up close, even a weed,
mm-hmm.
at the flower with a hand lens. And I don't remember, can you get books on this? So I'm hoping I sold a lot of books, not because of somebody making profit, but somebody got his nose
buried
in a book now where you would not have had otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So if my whole program netted through the years 15,000 good naturalists,
mm-hmm.
paid for itself, I think.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
And that's what my book is going to be about, too, along those lines. This is a book for naturalists. As you read it, you will recall some of these things. It'll bring back memories because you've seen the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a beginning naturalist, you'll see how interested you can get. And so follow up on these themes I've written my stories on and get out there and become a naturalist yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I can turn a lot of people on if I can just get them.
Mm-hmm. And if you have any final closing comments you'd like to make about your career, then you can go ahead.
No, I guess I've felt all the way along that I've accomplished a lot with my. We learned a lot about beaver, otter, and blackbird we didn't know before.
Mm-hmm.
We used that in management.
Mm-hmm.
I accomplished a lot, I think, with my naturalist programs.
Mm-hmm.
In that the people that I taught, I think a lot of them are much more attuned now to nature. plus the naturalists that took the walks with me, I know at least three of them that went on to become naturalists in various other places.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully they're carrying a story similar to mine to the people. But overall, I have had no regrets. And like I say, if I had to do it all over again, I'd sure jump on that. But I'd make some changes, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Who the heck wouldn't?
Mm-hmm.
But overall, well, I think people out here, we've got some tremendous neighbors here.
Mm-hmm.
Really old folks up in the hill there now, so they dote on us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
God, there might be a bunch of tomato soup sitting out here one day, and something else, you know. Someone knocking the door, bring you something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So we got four or five young couples here. We adopted them as our kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking care of us. And I take them out on little nature walks, and they just eat the stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice when you can do it with fewer people, because you can really get down into it then.
Mm-hmm.
See. But I hope I live long enough to finish that darn book. This is an old word processor. We've never gotten into computers at all because we're at the age where, geez, by the time we learn it, you know, so what?
Mm-hmm.
My wife was trying to work it out, and she doesn't do it often enough to stay with it, and
mm-hmm.
she forgets. So I got so much to do around here, I don't get to the writing, and I should.
Mm-hmm.
But I should finish that book, and I got a couple more I got in mind.
Okay.
I'd love to get them done, but I don't know if I will.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to seeing those then.
Yeah,
and,
I'll sure try. I know I told Arlene the other day, I said, there's one I could write in a hurry. If somebody was just, see how I'm talking here, yeah. If somebody would just let me talk and then summarize it all, I could have 1,600 pages in a book in 3 months. What about George? Well, I would title the book, A Curmudgeon Speaks. Wouldn't take me long to fill a book with that kind of stuff. Or in parentheses, parentheses, I guess. We're a bunch of damn hypocrites. And aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, you're reading in the detail, aren't we a bunch of hypocrites?
Mm-hmm.
Better believe it. We're great people, but boy, are we spoiled. Poof, are we spoiled.
Yes.
Yikes.
Well, thank you for being here with me today and for doing this interview with me.
Well, I hope it does some good for you.
Okay.